Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for The Diplomat and the Beyond the Mekong series. We're in Mae Sot and with me today is Paul Greening. Paul spent 20 years working for the United Nations in a variety of NGOs and now he's a Burma consultant and living in Mae Sot, and he has his eyes and ears to the ground and the civil war which is going on over there. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Luke. Happy to be here.
It's been quite a 6 months with the dry season offensive and the successes that have been recorded by the ethnic armed organisations and the People's Defence Force. Give us a quick summary. Where is it right now as the wet season is beginning?
Okay. No, you're right. About 6 months ago, in fact, it really knocked off on what they call this 10/27 offensive, which means the 27th of October.
Right.
That's when you had the Three Brotherhood Alliance, three ethnic resistance organisations with their armies, coordinated. They'd planned it for months. They'd obviously coordinated with China because it was along the border, and they attacked and they took about 50 towns.
Right.
This has continued. The Arakan army in Arakan has taken most of the north already. So it has escalated from that, in short, So at the moment, you have probably three, well, you have fronts all over the country, but probably three main fronts, I would say.
Mm.
Very recently, in the north, the Kachins have had an offensive, and it's going quite well for them, from what I can see at the moment. They're taking quite a few bases, quite a few military sites. You've also got in the Arakan army in the west, so that's the north, and in the west you've got the Arakan army, which has gained most of the north. They've got most of the Bangladesh border. I heard yesterday they are also, from getting one township, Butadong, near the border, they're now going for Mungda, which is on the border as well. They're very likely to get that, which means they'll control all the north.
Mm-hmm.
They're further south, the capital of Rakhine. They haven't got Sitwe, and they probably won't take it, because the hunters' reaction when a town is taken is to carpet bomb it,
right,
out of spite, more than no strategic relevance, usually just spite, and they don't want civilian casualties. Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine, already 65-70% of the population has left, in anticipation of the fight. I'm not sure if the fight will happen. I think their tactic will be, as it often is, to surround the town, cut off its resources to the military, starve it, and then have them surrender. They've done that to other places, and malnourished soldiers have come out and surrendered, happily surrendered. So I think that will happen.
Very old school.
It is. And also, the resistance is fully aware of this. So they make it attractive to defect.
Mm-hmm.
You had in Loy Kaur, in Kareni State, you had Maori, who was quite a chunky, well-known fighter for the Kareni Defence Force. And he was actually outside Loy Kaur University calling people out. No body armour, nothing, calling them out, calling the Burmese military soldiers out. Called them out. They got medical treatment, they got food, they got accommodation, they got money, and they got sent home.
Right.
Word gets around.
Yeah.
Because the Burmese military treat their soldiers pretty badly.
And they want conscripts.
Yes. Because a lot are defected. A lot have defected. We don't know exactly how many, but a lot have defected. Mm-hmm. So that is a very good tactic. Then you've got where we are now on the Thai border, just across from Mae Sot. We're talking about 7-8 kilometres away. We've got heavy fighting as well. We used to be able to hear it from Mae Sot. At the moment we can't, because it's not right on the border. It's a little bit further away. You had Mae Wadi town that was officially taken by the Kareni Liberation Army.
KNLA.
KNLA. Officially taken. And then, thanks to the Border Guard Force and their connivance, I guess, it got given back.
Right.
But the bases in that area around Mae Wadi town are controlled by the KNLA.
But I've been told a couple of versions of this. One is that, as you were saying before, the junta's habit of bombing cities that they've lost, and the KNLA was quite frightful that there'd be enormous civilian casualties should the junta retaliate on that score. Plus, I'm told there was a lot of pressure from Thailand in that, as we know, Mae Sot and Miyawati it's a major border town. There's about $1 billion in trade goes through there in a year. Most of that money goes to Thailand. And as I was told, is that the Thais said to the KNLA, we're not losing that, and we want you to do a deal with the Border Guard Force, the BGF, and we're not going to reshape our foreign policy to please an independent Karen state. There's different names for it. But what they did say was, we'll look at renegotiating should you take Yangon. That came out in one meeting. Is that possible to take Yangon yet? Or is that
still... This, I would say, is incorrect.
I'm
sure that's incorrect.
Right.
This talking about taking Yangon. As for Miyawati, yes, they didn't want it bombed. The Thais would have been involved, talking to all sides. Uh-huh. They would have been. They were putting pressure on the SAC as well.
The
Special Advisory Council of MEMA, which is the junta. They put pressure on them. Inevitably, they put pressure on them because it's a main trading post,
right.
And they don't want a lot of refugees coming over. Already they had 3,000-4,000 coming over. Most have gone back, but they don't want a flood of hundreds of thousands. They said they're ready for 100,000. They've actually said that, this new Thai government, but they don't want it.
Sure.
It's a pain. It's a pain in the backside, to be honest, right, for them. They don't want that. So they don't want that. They were talking to all sides, definitely. As for taking Yangon, I don't think that was even a question for them. I don't know if they're really too worried about that from the Thai point of view. BGF is a Karen organisation. They have ties with KNLA and other Karen armed groups. They are often interrelated, literally. They're connected. They don't want to be, Karen don't want to be killing Karen as well.
Right.
That's why they haven't been fighting the BGF. That's one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you had planes coming over, you had got drones from the Myanmar military, and you got them with their convoy coming towards Miyawati.
Yep, there was a Red Cross convoy in April.
No, I mean military convoy.
Okay.
The military convoy coming. When you've got all of this happening, KNLA has to decide, do they stay put and fight to keep Miyawati town?
Mm-hmm.
When the Thais don't want it, they're going to get it carpet bombed, it's not going to help them, they're going to be in a very difficult position and exposed. Or do they pull out and go on the outskirts of Miyawati town, which they are now? And there's four main bases in Miyawati area. They've got three of them still. There's one that they haven't got, 275, which they had to let go. And now Miyawati has got the BGF patrolling it.
Mm-hmm.
They're making deals with everyone they can think of, or anything that's going to be of use to them. And they're making deals with the military not to bomb them.
And the BGF is about 7,000 to 10,000.
Yes, about 7,200. I worked out with the number of battalions, roughly.
According to a recent report by the United States Institute for Peace, it lays the blame and accuses the BGF of controlling the human trafficking networks, which just adds another complicated layer to the equation, which is but a few kilometres from here.
Yeah, there was a very extensive report by the
USIP.
The USIP, but also another one, Justice for Myanmar,
okay.
JMF. They did a very extensive report that talks about the BGF in detail.
Right.
And they've got their hands in all the pies. The Chinese companies, the Yala company, they made deals with them, they control the areas, but they do the protection, often they rent out the buildings, they rent out the land. And it's not just Swakopmund or KK Park, the two main sort of casino scamming centres, it's the others as well. They've got their hands in all the pies.
Right.
And if you check out the leader, Chitu, of the Border Guard Force, he's got lots of companies. He's involved in everything you can think of, from gypsum to everything. Yeah, he's extremely wealthy man, which is another reason that people don't touch him. He can pay people off.
Indeed.
He can pay people off. Like, why haven't the scam centres been closed? Why are people being trafficked through Thailand, through all the checkposts and everything to get there?
It's quite funny.
That is, I suspect, because someone high up in the Thai government is being paid off by the Border Guard Force. Well,
there was that recent story where the Thais said they were going to cut the internet connections to Shwe Coco, which is okay, so you're admitting you have these connections there, you know what's going on, and you are providing them with the digital logistical facilities to enable the scam compounds, or as some people are now calling them, scam cities. But it prompted me to do a search, and you go back a year or two, and the Thais were also announcing that they had cut Shwe Coco off, that they had cut electricity supplies and water to Shwe Coco. Now, that was a year or two ago, so it's obviously been reconnected at some point.
And also, just after that happened, people went to Shwe Coco and the lights were all on.
Right.
It's actually getting bigger, because as we talked about in the north of Myanmar, when the military lost some areas there, they lost areas that were scam centres.
Right.
And that's why the Chinese let this happen. That's why the Chinese gave the nod to the resistance, you know, go ahead and take it.
Have a few guns and...
Take it, because we want the people back. So about 40,000 got sent back to China.
Yep.
A lot of others have moved down to this area. So it's actually expanded. This area has actually expanded with, I think there's about 24 casinos, maybe more, along the river. Mm. We all know about KK Park and Shwe Coco, but there's a lot of others. And the Border Guard Force has got its hands in a lot of them. So that's another reason, because of the money as well. And also, we have to remember, and it's no secret, that the Keren National Union, and the KNLA is the armed wing of that, some of those people have got their hands in those casinos as well. So they have vested interest. Then we can also take some of the Keren people. Some of the Keren people are working there. I don't mean scammers.
No, legitimate jobs.
Legitimate jobs, cleaners, drivers, construction, etc. They're probably making more money than would on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
They have an interest as well. So there's various interests there. So basically now, if you look at Mir Wadi, the situation is you have the BGF patrolling, and I know this, a friend contacted me from Mir Wadi yesterday, they're patrolling the centre.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's some SAC, the Burmese military, that are there as well with them. They can also change uniforms quite easily. That's not a problem. So I'm sure they're there as well, in the centre. You've got one base controlled by the Burmese military, three bases controlled by KNLA. Then on the outskirts, going out the next stage out, you have a convoy. This has been coming for a long, long time.
If I remember correctly, that was the column that was deployed to rescue the soldiers at Battalion 275 and never quite got there. And
exactly.
They've had these failed attempts at crossing the Dorna Mountain Range, which they have to take if they are going to retake Mir Wadi.
Yeah.
And that just does not look doable.
No. You've got the KNLA Alliance mm-hmm. meaning with People's Defence Force groups.
Mm-hmm.
Some main ones there. They're fighting there to stop them. And it's quite reasonably easy. And now we've got the rain starting, even easier to stop them coming through the mountains.
Right.
So you've got them coming, but that could be 1,000 troops.
Yep.
They've got armoured cars. For some reason, they didn't bring tanks, which is strange. I thought they'd bring tanks, but I don't know why. So you've got them, and there's heavy fighting going on there. But go a bit further, and you've got Kokore, another town which was taken by the KNLA Alliance. Then it was taken back again by the Burmese military. There's heavy fighting there, very heavy fighting. And it shows the strategic importance of Mir Wadi for the Burmese military, that they're putting some of their best troops in there. I've talked to people who've been fighting there. They say, we're taking a lot of casualties. They've got not the old men ready to surrender or forced conscripts. They've got good fighting force with good strategy and with good tactics and with knowledge. They're using drones, etc. Some of the Russian drones, which the Burmese military has just bought, sophisticated, most of them are kamikaze drones. I suspect they can fly in the rain as well. When the resistance are using American agricultural drones that have been adapted with string and wire. But these from Russia are sophisticated. They've got those there as well. I've heard from a very, very good source that they've got those there. So there's heavy fighting there. But the resistance is holding them there, and they're holding the convoy. But they're still trying to come in. Now, Whether they bomb some of the military bases near Merwadi or not, I don't know. It's been quiet for a while. They could do that. With planes, they have to be careful. Because a plane, if it bombs within 1.5 kilometres of the border, it will come into Thailand to turn.
Right.
And Thailand now is under a civilian government, mm-hmm. which is a little bit different to the past. So they're not going to turn that blind eye. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the Thai army is too keen on any forces coming on their land. I don't think they were keen before, but they were stopped politically. Now I don't think they're too keen. So they have to be very careful with that as well. But there could be a big fight on the outskirts of Merwadi in the near future. That's quite possible.
You've said before that you don't necessarily think the fighting will subside because of the wet season. Other people say it should, but you're not of that thinking.
No, it's possible. It's all prediction. But I remember with the Arakan War, 2018, I was in Sitwe, the capital of Arakan State, and people were saying the same. It didn't happen. They carried on fighting just as intensely. And the junta, their jets can fly in the rain. Helicopters, not so good. The drones, their new drones, maybe. Also, the resistance can move reasonably effectively in their areas. They know how to move through their areas in the rain. I don't think it's going to subside much. That's my opinion. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to subside much. There's always this general idea that it will. People always say that. Rainy comes, it's going to subside.
Absolutely.
But that is just people tend to automatically say that without analysing the different forces. So
perhaps they'd like the fighting to subside for a while too.
Yeah, but people automatically say that because often that's what happens. Mm. I don't think that will necessarily happen now. I don't. I predict it would continue intensively. And I think the resistance from all fronts, mm-hmm. You've got many, many different aspects and it's quite fluid. So to predict what's going to happen is quite difficult.
It is, and I'm going to ask you to do that.
I know.
Again. So
I know.
It's a little bit like, okay, so really what's left is Barma province and the Irrawaddy Basin, so you're looking at Yangon,
Mandalay and Naypyidaw.
Thank you. Now, are the EAOs and the PDF, are they going to have a crack at these major towns? Are they going to try and overrun Barma province, or are they going to simply sit back, consolidate their victories and declare independence?
That's very interesting. I read a report by the Lowry Institute today, which an academic report, which I disagree with strongly.
That's okay, ripping door.
Yeah, no, I disagree strongly. Yeah. Because they were saying that the military is too strong, which is a typical thing people say.
The military is too strong.
The Burmese military is too strong.
Well,
they can't
count as with... against what I've heard from the Americans. They don't... I've heard lots of arguments that say they simply don't have the troop strength to match the EAOs.
But they're saying they can't... What will happen is, as you're saying, they'll consolidate their strengths along the border, which is where most of the EROs are, ethnic resistance organisations, and they'll leave the centre and it will be separate. And they're saying they can't touch the military, the Burmese military power base. And they were actually saying this was perhaps a desirable thing. I think that's, to be honest, I think that's ridiculous. It's not desirable at all.
I think it also ignores the attitudes that's coming forward from the younger generation who are fighting this war.
It's an insult to them.
It's
a total insult to them. This will not happen. You can't leave the regime, even in Naypyidaw, because it will come back again. It thinks it has this God-written right to rule the country and exploit it. So it has to be finished. They have to go back to their barracks. And the whole regime has to change, which means the Bama regime. After the British left, Second World War, independence, the Bama took over, and it's often happened in other countries, took over a colonial-type role. Mm-hmm. The ethnic resistance organisations will not accept that. Not anymore. And they're the ones that are going to win the war. They're going to win the war because they've got the main fighting forces. The People's Defence Forces, even if they're under the National Union Government, they have been trained and have comrades who are in the ethnic resistance organisations. So their loyalty, their heart is with them. Mm-hmm. They're ones who are going to win the war. They're the ones that will be able to make a lot of the decisions. They're united, more than ever. People say they're all split up and fighting because they see a couple of sham groups that don't get on. No, the bigger ones, the strong ones, are united. They've been fighting together. They've been talking. Some have been talking for decades and working together. No, they're going to come together. They're going to keep on fighting. They get the last places to go, of course, will be Yangon, Mandalay, Naypyidaw.
But they'll be the last, you're saying.
Yep, and they're going to strangle it. They'll strangle it. They'll cut off the bases. They've already got within 10 kilometres of Naypyidaw. They've been bombing bases there.
Right.
They've even, Naypyidaw, an Air Force base nearby, they flew over and bombed it with drones.
Well, I was going to say that there was that once in a blue moon open-air meeting about Myanmar, the UN Security Council, and as I was standing up to talk, the ethnic resistance forces were bombing the headquarters of the junta in Naypyidaw with drones. And it was like, they have learnt a lot. That was very clever.
Yeah, so they can get there. It's not without their reach.
Mm-hmm.
It's not armoured.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the Burmese military has been used to putting down small resistance groups and going there, not having them come to them.
Mm-hmm.
So their airports, the military airports, etc., airfields, are not that well protected. They don't expect outside attacks. They're not designed for that. Is a place to take off and attack another area. So they're quite vulnerable. And the resistance organisations have realised that and are attacking them. And they'll continue attacking them. It's not desirable, it will not happen, that it will be isolated groups. What will happen, I think, I don't know when, I'd like to say a year, but it's probably longer. That's probably me being more sort of optimistic than anything. The resistance organisations will win. Then what happens? Then I don't think the NUG or the NLD will move into power again and say, right, we're the legitimate government.
I don't think that can happen either. And from what I'm told, the people in the National Unity Government, what they want to do, which is reinstall the government that was elected in November 2020, it's just not going to happen. It can't go back to that. And the EAS, and I'll just quickly point out that Paul is referring to ethnic resistance organisations, I am referring to ethnic armed organisations. It is a sea of acronyms over there, and we are actually talking about the same groups. But the EAOs, or EROs, as you want to call them, they're fighting for other reasons, and it's their independence that matters.
But also now they realise, in the past, for example, the KNU have been fighting for about 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
They've been fighting to get independence for their own area.
Right.
Now they realise they can't just do that. They have to get the whole country changed. You know, they can't just get independence for their area. It's not going to happen.
I was at a conference in Bangkok on what comes next in Burma, and what was raised, the EAOs, or the ethnic groups, traditionally they do not want to go out and fight outside their state, their home territories. Mm. And what looks like being put together is forming these new militias. So the PDF, which on paper anyway, under the NUG, is forming different militias with the different ethnic groups to push the fight beyond their state borders. And I was told that the TNLA is one group that is doing that. And the EAOs are better trained than the PDFs. They've got better weapons, they've been at it longer, they know how to fight, it's home territory, that kind of thing. Is that a real prospect for the next year or two going forward?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. For example, you've got the Bama People's Liberation Army,
right,
which has got about 750 troops now, reasonably well armed, affiliated with other armed resistance organisations, led by a poet called Mong Sanka. He's a poet and he used to run a civil society organisation looking at freedom of the press, etc.
Mm-hmm.
He decided after peaceful demonstrations that the only way was to pick up a gun. He's very charismatic, and he started an armed group. They got 750. They're joining other armed groups fighting all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, it's no big secret, you've got the main group that will be attacking Yangon, or very close to Yangon, is 5101, run by a man who looks more like an accountant, who's an intellectual, mm-hmm, a very clever man, someone that will go into politics afterwards. Just like Mong Sanka, he's inevitably going to be in politics afterwards.
Right.
But these are the new generations that have got armies behind them. They've got armies of their own, but also they're joining with the EROs as well. And they're getting on well with them. That's one thing as well. Because of this conflict,
mm-hmm.
people, ethnic groups that wouldn't mix normally are. Suddenly the people on the border, the Kereni, the Keren, mm-hmm. KIA, Kachin, sorry, you had suddenly a lot of Bama fleeing the cities,
mm-hmm.
wanting, train us to fight, we have to fight, we're being killed on the streets, train us to fight. They hadn't had much contact with them before. The Bama were their enemies.
Right.
They represented the government that was yeah. trying to suppress them. Now they're working together. Now they're much closer. There's a lot more understanding.
Well, we're meeting them here in May's site, and that most of the people from Myanmar who are 25 to 35, that age group, are affiliated with the PDF or the KNLA. Big numbers of them that we've met. Mon, Bama, Chin, not just Karen. It's kind of like everybody is here, and they drink together, they work together, they look out for each other. They've got a real thing happening.
Yeah. Right. You talk about people I mix and drink with.
Sure.
these are friends of mine.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is happening. Coming back to your question, what will happen? I think the ethnic resistance organisations will win.
Mm-hmm.
NUG will sort of set up some provisional council of some sort,
mm-hmm.
probably representatives, all of those, and it will gradually get sorted out. So you'll have not federal, but more confederate states
mm-hmm.
with their own education, with still maintaining their own weapons and their own guns, and probably their own economy as well, but connected with the General Assembly, with a rotating committee
mm-hmm.
from all the different representatives to represent the country, foreign affairs, general economy, etc., but not with a strong dominating economy, not with a strong dominating army.
Right.
People aren't going to go back to that because they trust the Bama before, they're never going to trust the Bama again.
That's the theme I keep hearing.
Yeah, so it's going to be fairly loose Confederate states.
Right.
It's not going to break up. Some people say it's going to break up and you have the balkanization.
Mm.
I don't believe that because people aren't stupid. They realize it's not in their interests.
Do you foresee a need for United Nations peacekeepers as, say, what was witnessed in Cambodia in the early 1990s?
The peacekeepers, if they came in like in Timor-Leste, and
mm-hmm.
started fighting the Indonesian military and getting rid of them.
Well, there are issues over borders on that one.
Yeah.
Different maps for a start. But
yeah.
I'm even thinking of the protection of the Bama. I mean, it's if they have control of their states, one suggestion is that the peacekeepers could be brought in basically as a marker around Bama in the centre and that Irrawaddy Basin area, Naypyidaw, Mandalay and Yangon, at least until they can get the political act together.
You mean before the war's
well,
over?
Well, it'd have to come later. If we take it to a full conclusion, how would the war end? I mean, the General Hlaing might try and negotiate his way out. He might flee. He could be strung up and quartered. But
yeah.
There's all sorts of potential.
There's different
scenarios that could happen. And I know that suggesting peacekeepers for Myanmar would collectively make the UN just cough. Now, they're not interested in spending $10, $15, $20 billion, which could well people shrieked at the cost of UN peacekeepers in Cambodia in the 1990s, and that was about $2 or $3 billion. So we'd probably be looking at like $10, $15 billion at least.
Mm.
And when they're all more concerned with Gaza, Israel, Russia, Ukraine. But the point is it needed?
I think there's a couple of things here. First, the UN is not exactly popular.
Right.
People see lots of photographs of UN officials, top officials, shaking hands with Min Aung Hlaing, and they
mm-hmm.
know it's for their own interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for the country's interest. They've got very little access. The only way they can deliver aid is
mm-hmm.
with the military, the Myanmar military, saying you can go there, you can go there,
right.
Which means they can weaponize the aid, etc. They're doing it basically for their own interest because they have a presence in the country. They think they get more likely to get donor money,
mm-hmm.
so we can blame the donors for that as well. And then when it's over, they're in a nice position for all the development money to come in and them to continue.
That just sounds like Cambodia, Afghanistan.
So there's not an awful lot of faith in the UN. So I think there'd be resistance, and I don't, as you say very rightly, the UN would not be really interested. They didn't, you know, they know very little about what's actually happening. People have talked to the State Department in America, who are some of the best.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in America, not the ones in Bangkok, in America.
Yeah, yeah, and I know
they
what you mean.
And they realise that they don't really know what's happening.
Yeah.
I've talked to different diplomats, and I've been quite shocked.
How little they know.
So I don't think there will be any interest in that at all. And of course, you put the UN in, then you've got the
what alternatives?
The idea of America. Right. Then you've got the possibility China's not going to be too happy with that.
China, India, and Bangladesh can't be involved. You can't, I mean, if it's not the UN, it's not going to be ASEAN.
Well, China will probably definitely be involved. It's China's very clever. It's very strategic, much more than India.
Mm.
It's playing all sides.
Mm-hmm.
It's playing all sides. So, you know, it will talk to the ethnic resistance organisations. It will support the KIA.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a big surprise that
KIA being the Kachin
Independence Army. Up in the north.
Further.
Yeah. So they're supporting them. And it's not a big surprise that quite a few of the weapons that we see the resistance has are Chinese made.
Indeed.
And that could come from the Wa, which is another semi-autonomous area, which is very close, and they're virtually Chinese. They use the script, they use the money, everything, the renminbi. So you've got them. So China is definitely involved. It's also talking to the military, but it's playing all sides, because whichever side it goes, it's going to be in a good position. India has not been quite so clever. On the other side, it has been staunchly supporting the SAC.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
they've got all those lucrative contracts to service those jets which were provided by the Russians.
Exactly. But the main concern is the Caladan Highway going through northeastern India and also going around to Calcutta. That is on hold, has been on hold for a long time because of the American war, and also now because of the resistance at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The revolution at the moment. You've got that. And interestingly, India, soon as the AA took Palawa,
mm-hmm.
which is actually officially in Chin state, which is on the border with India, India started talking to the AA.
Right.
They realised. And I think soon as AA takes it, they're going to have to... They're not that stupid. They'll talk to the AA to get the highway coming through. Deals will be made, and that's what will happen. But generally, for the whole country, they're not so... They're interested in that. The whole country... They'll support the military at the moment, but they're not going to have so much influence. China will have a lot more influence. They're not going to be kingmakers, but they'll have a lot more influence. And China was not too happy about the coup. It objected to the coup, in fact. Just before the coup, there were some very heavy conversations between the Chinese and the Myanmar military, and just afterwards there's heavy conversations. They were quite happy with Aung San Suu Kyi and NLD. Their projects were going on, maybe held up by environmental studies and assessments, but it was going on. So they're happy. Now, the Road and Belt is not happening.
No, it has stopped.
Yeah, and they're not happy about that.
For lots of reasons.
Yeah.
Myanmar, the reasons are obvious.
Yeah, and you know, Chopio down in Arakan State, you know, they can't really do much there now. There's a war going on there.
Indeed.
So they will be quite happy if the resistance wins. They get stability and they can carry on with economic development.
Paul, one last question. How long do you think it'll take?
That's a very good question. Some people say years. I would say it could happen within a year.
Right.
Now, because I think things will get to such a stage that they get to a tipping point. Then it will go over. For example, the resistance organisations and then UG are coordinating extremely well. If that continues and improves, then their attacks is going to improve. You've got that happening. I think also the Myanmar military could implode from the bottom up or the top down. Min Aung Hlaing could be running over to Russia. China won't take him. And some other generals will try and come in and try and make deals, or from the bottom up, because there's a lot of soldiers that are disgruntled at the bottom. Mm-hmm. That's half starving, and the rainy season, half starving the rainy season, they'll love that. And then you've got those at the top that aren't making so much money now, because it's a business. They haven't got the income coming in. They're losing.
Right.
So they're not going to be too happy. So I think that could implode. The resistance will increase. We'll end up with ethnic resistance organisations winning with some sort of general assembly in the centre. And I don't think we'll need the UN in there. I think the Burmese, this is Burmese run. They've run it. They're winning the war. They haven't had the support that they need internationally, and they're still doing it, so it's going to be a homegrown victory, and they'll continue in that way.
On that note, Paul Greening, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Luke. I enjoyed it.
Cheers, mate.
It's okay.